Important people are here.
That's right. The committee will come to order. We have a pretty full agenda today, so we're going to get started on time here. The presentations today are around our issues of housing and some of the work that we need to do this session on the issues of housing. Housing as both federal issues, some of the stimulus package, we've got some information on that. Looking at a local study, too, on economic stimulus and hearing from our community action agency on the work that they are intending to do with us. So the first presentation is from our community action partnership, and I'd like to ask them to come forward. You can have as many seats as you want. That's great. We're glad to have you all here.
Well,
there we go. That's it. We are starting without our full quorum, but we'll go forward with some very significant legislators who are sitting over there to my left. Again, welcome to the committee. Introduce
Madam
yourself.
Chair, members, my name is Arnie Anderson. I'm the director of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. We're thrilled to be here today. Thank you very much for your time. On the other hand, this is one of the hardest days of the year for us because community action is so complex. It's very difficult to talk about it briefly. What we'd really love to do is spend the morning with you in the back room at the Chatterbox Cafe and hear the whole community action story.
Maybe that can be arranged.
That would be wonderful. So for today, I will offer a few comments about an overview of community action. We have Angie Miller, who is the executive director at Duluth Community Action, who will talk briefly about one of our powerful growth areas, tax prep and financial literacy training. We're very pleased to have Dr. Jody Sandberg with us today. She'll talk briefly about a study that she's working on about the power of networks, nonprofit networks. And we have Patrick McFarland, who is executive director of Anoka Community Action. Anoka Community Action is in the thick of this year's economic crisis. And he'll talk briefly about how their community action agency is responding to that. So, if I may, you have our brand new report. We just got this from the printer last night. I believe you have it in your packet, and you have tab pages that we'll try to hop through quickly. The first tab page that I would like to draw your attention to is the red tab on page 18. Community action basics. The thing about community action that makes community action unique is our one-third board membership, where a third of the board members are required to be low-income Minnesotans. It gives community action a very different orientation and mission. People love community action. Last year, more than 35,000 people volunteered for local community action agencies, in excess of 1.7 million hours. Next, I would like to draw your attention to the blue tab on pages 30 and 31. This is a table that displays the wide array of programming delivered by community action agencies. Everything from children to seniors. But the thing that we love to say is that it's difficult to generalize about community action. When you see one community action agency, you see one community action agency. They've all grown up locally with their own special mix of local needs and local resources. Rather than spending any more time on a formal presentation with this report, we'll leave it to you to thumb through it as we go through our presentation. And now I would like to introduce to you Dr. Jody Sanford from the Humphrey Institute at the University of Minnesota. Some of her extensive accomplishments are on the beige handout at the front of your report. She specializes in nonprofit management and has been conducting a study of two networks. And I'm going to pass the microphone over to Dr. Sanford to talk about her study and why it may be of particular interest to you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and
welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me. I was asked to come before you on behalf of the Community Action Partnership. For the last 2 years, I've been studying two nonprofit networks because of my interest in their role in the implementation of social policy. I'm using multiple data collection methods, including surveys, interviews, review of documents, and in-depth examination of four organizations, and I'm comparing these organizations to others in the state of Minnesota. This study occurs in a particular context. As you know, in the latter part of the 20th century, governments at all levels increasingly contracted with nonprofits as vendors of human service provision. This ideology, what academics call the new public management, embraced business approaches and presumed that competition would lead to more efficient and effective services. Yet research is increasingly challenging whether or not these assumptions hold. In fact, there are many unintended consequences of merely thinking of nonprofits as vendors for governments, for the agencies themselves, and for citizens. Governments don't maximize their investments if they treat nonprofits merely as vendors. Nonprofits are also burdened by disconnected reporting requirements and performance measures. Some of the community action agencies in this network, for example, report over 100 distinct funding streams upon which they must track, manage, and report on. Citizens, when confronted with a variety of community agencies, must navigate the web that is very complicated, and often that burden falls disproportionately on low-income families. In this context, I wanted to learn more about what alternative service structures might be created, what could improve government investment, what could enhance service quality for citizens. This led me to my current study of two networks of Minnesota's human service agencies. One network, the one here, the Community Action Partnership, has its origins in the anti-poverty work of the Great Society. It was formed because of top-down mandates in the mid-60s when the government created new nonprofits to aid in their war on poverty. The other network, the MAC Alliance for Connected Communities, formed 10 years ago from a bottom-up impulse from settlement houses and community centers that were trying to build on their almost 100-year history to remake themselves in the face of a new era. Both networks provide social services to low-income Minnesotans. Both have nonprofit organizations at the hub of their network. While ongoing, this research yields at least three lessons relevant to the deliberations of this committee. First, these cases illustrate the significance of government working with intentional networks. Each month, the executive directors of these two networks gather to share information and improve their overall operations. Their staff in human resources, in financing, in programming gather as well. They share questions about operations, and they generate answers. When times get tough, they draw upon the collective resources of the whole in small and in large ways. By coming together, the 28 executive directors of Community Action and the 25 executive directors of the MAC Alliance create an identity that improves the effectiveness of their organizations and the entire human service system. It helps them see the order underlying the chaos that characterizes the contracting out regime. Secondly, this study uncovers the significance of public investments beyond narrow categorical funding. One of our deep beliefs in Minnesota is that communities themselves hold many solutions to problems. And yet the structure of much public funding pulls organizations away from listening to their constituents. Government's categorical program rules literally make them unable to hear. Private philanthropy, a long important partner in public service provision, has followed suit with increasingly narrow investments. Few revenue sources beyond the Minnesota Community Action Grant and the Community Services Block Grant provide resources which enable nonprofit leaders to listen to communities and to respond. public investments also go beyond grant dollars. In the community action case, the state's investment in the Office of Economic Opportunity allows these nonprofits to share essential field-based insights with state government. It connects them with technical assistance, federal grant opportunities, and insightful staff. It operates not merely as a funder, but as a partner. Finally, my study suggests great potential for the public sector in working with intermediary organizations. My first encounters with community action, actually, were when I was the director of the Children and Families Program at the McKnight Foundation. In that role, I worked with the Network Hub of Community Action as an intermediary to assist to maximize my investments and leverage programmatic expertise throughout the network. I worked with the MAC Alliance in similar ways. This experience and my subsequent research has emphasized to me the significant potential of this new model of government and nonprofit relationships. I do not envy the decisions that face this committee and the legislature in the months ahead. However, unlike narrow lobbying that you receive from particular nonprofits about particular categorical funding programs, the work of community action is an investment in a potent infrastructure for the state of Minnesota in the new century. Our citizens benefit from your foresight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sanford. Next, I'd like to draw your attention briefly to the yellow tab, page 57. This is an example of one of the management innovations that we're able to implement by virtue of being a statewide network. It's a powerful new client database that community action agencies have partnered to be able to implement. Some of the efficiencies include a centralized system operation and management and centralized training for community action's 5,000 employees. To give you an example of one of the potential innovations that might result from this database, many of you are familiar with the combined application form that Minnesotans use to apply for health programs and food support and cash assistance. When someone comes to a community action agency, our database will be able to pre-script many of the fields in that form so that when they go to the county and interface with the skill position, the county financial worker, the form for us has already been completed, and it's our hope that we'll be able to work with some counties so that we'll get to the point that they can literally scan that form into their system and avoid having duplicate keystrokes and the errors that go with that. So we're excited about many, many aspects of this system, but that's one concrete example. Next, I'd like to introduce to you Angie Miller. She's the Executive Director at Duluth Community Action. She's going to talk about free tax preparation services and financial literacy today. I believe in your packet you have a light green handout that Angie may be referencing.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and
welcome to the city.
Nice to see my very own Representative Tom Huntley here, too, a friendly face in the crowd. My name is Angie Miller, and as Arnie said, I'm the Director of Community Action Duluth. Last night, I was volunteering at our pre-tax site, and when we opened the doors at 4:30, there was a line of people, and as you know, it was cold last night in Duluth. There was a line of people down the block. 37 people were waiting when our doors opened to get into our doors to have their taxes done for free. And that night, 15 volunteers were in our office and ready to go and hit the ground running, because when we open the door, we hand out numbers. And we, by the end of the night, have taken care of all of those people who are standing in line and hopefully did not turn away too many. Last year we did taxes for 1,300 people. The average income of all of those people was $14,000 for their annual income. So these are very low income people, which explains why are they waiting outside of our doors every time we're open to get their taxes done. And the answer is because it costs $100 to $200 to get your taxes done at a commercial preparer. So we're talking about very low-income people. We serve seniors, people with disabilities, working families who have multiple jobs, and it's people who cannot afford the tax prep fees. So it's a very high return on investment because the program is totally a volunteer program. We have over 60 volunteers and only 2 part-time paid seasonal staff to run the whole program. So it's a volunteer-driven effort. So it's a very low-cost way to provide services. And then we've added on quite a few extras at our tax site. So we've kind of turned it into a one-stop shop. You can open a savings account at a local credit union right while you're at our site getting your taxes done. This year, you can purchase a savings bond, a U.S. savings bond, right out of your refund at our tax site. And the interest rate on these now is 5.6%. It's a fabulous interest rate. So we're encouraging our tax site customers to build their assets by purchasing a savings bond for themselves or their children. You can also meet with a person who, in just 5 minutes, using a Children's Defense Fund computer program, can tell you if you're eligible for food support or energy assistance or health care coverage. And we find a lot of people are eligible for programs like that that they weren't aware that they met the guidelines for or they weren't aware of. You can also, if you need to, you can do a rapid refund where for a very low cost, between $5 and $22, you can borrow your refund and get it the next day. Some people are in a jam, and this is a service we provide to keep them out of a predatory product. And we find last year we did 83 of these refund loans. So it's across the state, community action agencies have either operated now or are supporting 350 free tax sites for a total of 1,000 volunteers, and last year $57 million in refunds were generated for the customers of these tax sites. One of the ancillary services that we are educating our tax site customers about is the opportunity to take a financial class. Every month we have financial education classes that are open to the public. They're in the evenings, we offer child care, and they're free. And the classes are full, and people, 96% of people who start the class finish the whole 12-hour class, and we focus on reducing your debt, understanding your credit score, and learning how to improve your credit. We talk about investing. Low-income people are interested in learning about how to save for their retirement. It surprised us, but it's a very interesting topic to everyone, and including low-income people. We talk about avoiding predatory lending and choosing bank and insurance products wisely. So it's a great class. There's a big demand. We started providing these classes to high school-age people this year, and so financial education, asset building, and financial stability are maybe not programs you necessarily associate with community action agencies. People think of us as the Head Start and the weatherization providers, which are crucial services and important. But it's good for you to understand that also we're working on financial stability and asset building through our agencies as well. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Last year when we were before this committee, Representative Schumper was speaking at some length about the role of community action in the southeast Minnesota floods, which is a natural disaster, and we have participated over the years in a number of those. This year we're in the midst of an economic disaster. Our last speaker is going to be Patrick McFarland, Executive Director of Anoka County Community Action Program, who's going to talk to you just a little bit about some of the things he's experiencing at his agency.
Madam Chair, members, Patrick McFarland, Anoka County Community Action Program. Very much a pleasure to be here. Appreciate the support of the committee over the years. Rather than doing the Community Action 101, we're kind of talking a bit about the economic tsunami that's going over the top of us right now. I'd like to apologize. I've just got this terrible head cold, and taking enough drugs that I can't really feel my feet at this point. I thought I'd feel a lot better coming to talk to the Public Health Committee, but it doesn't seem to be working out for me. So maybe I'm going to have to talk to Representative Huntley's committee later and just see if he makes me feel better. We had a board meeting, Joint Policy Council board meeting last night at our agency to talk a little bit about the stimulus package. And this was coincidental. The president signed the bill yesterday. I think they were still typing the bill as he was signing the bill. We got a summary of the bill and went through it and talked about what we are going to do at Anoka County Community Action as a result of the stimulus package. And it's pretty interesting, I think. The stimulus package for someone in my line of work is just exactly like a kid in the candy store. I mean, there is so many programs, so many things that are funded in that bill that it's almost overwhelming to think about. And I think we're going to have to really pull together as a state and a community to deliver this. But what we talked about last night is kind of interesting. Foreclosure prevention and mitigation. We currently have 5 people working full-time on this program. Last December of 2007, we had 1 half-time person working on foreclosure. So that program has really increased. We have a housing hotline that we set up just for Anoka County. There's 5,000 calls in that housing hotline in the last 12 months. I shared with Representative Lane some data on that. I have that data if you're interested, but I won't pass that out here, but I can get that to her for you. We're interested to see what the president does today in his foreclosure prevention program. I was talking to my counselors. They said if they had about $5,000 average person in foreclosure, we can save that house probably, if it's not gotten beyond the sheriff's sale. We've had 3,000 sheriff sales last 12 months in Anoka County. Our housing hotline last week from 11 o'clock on Friday to Tuesday morning received 91 calls. We had 91 discrete calls on that. So things are I think, still peaking, but hopefully if the president has a good program in place, we're ready to implement it. There is a nationwide network that does that. The home weatherization in the stimulus package will increase our jobs by about 13-fold. We're currently doing 100 jobs a year in weatherization in Anoka County. We'll do 1,300 over the next 2 years. Today, as we speak, we're interviewing energy auditors. That's going to be the big bottleneck. There's plenty of laborers to do the weatherization activities and contractors out there. But just to get the homes certified and audited is going to be challenging. The NSP program, the Neighborhood Stabilization Program that you talked about, we're working with Anoka County on that. We talked about that last night at our board meeting. Looks to me like we will be doing the rehab portion of that for the county. We'll be using our prisoner-built construction crews to do some of that rehab. Those are county prisoners, inmates they're called. And that our home ownership center will be doing the counseling for the purchase. You know, the HUD requires that you have counseling with that. There's also an additional amount of money in the NSP program in the stimulus package. That's going to be all competitively. And we're talking with the county about perhaps applying for that some of that money competitively. The Child Care Development Block Grant has $2 billion in it. We run Child Care Resource and Referral in Anoka County, Child Care Assistance Subsidy for the county, and Healthy Start for Anoka County. And I think all those programs are also for CCDBG funding. Head Start has $1 billion nationwide expansion under formula. That'll probably be about 40 kids for us. We're ready for those kids. We have the space for them and we have the staff for them at this point. $1.1 billion of early Head Start are competitive. We have grants ready to go for competitive early Head Start. We can serve probably another 120 kids. We're currently serving 120 kids in that program. Home and CDBG has a total of $3 billion. We have a number of rehab programs we have 400 units of housing that could use some rehab and other kinds of activities. We'll be applying for that money through the county. The training employment has $3.94 billion nationwide, and a big component of youth component. Madam Chair, we're looking at youth build. for Anoka County, weatherization kinds of activities and other kinds of activities in the apprentice training program, kind of pre-apprentice training program. The early shelters grant program, a HUD program for homelessness. We provide the shelter services in the county, transitional and other kinds of housing with other partners, and we'll be beefing that up and applying for those grants as they come available. And finally, there's the FEMA Emergency Shelter Grant Program, $100 million. Oak County's getting $113,000. We'll get $226,000, and we're all set to go with that. That goes out to the food shelves and other folks. So as soon as you get us the money, we're ready to spend it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's very exciting to hear the readiness from this panel. I'm really excited about that, and there'll probably be questions from our committee members. I know Representative Paul had his hand up already. I can kind of guess he might be aiming at one that I'm interested in. Representative Paul?
Madam Chair, I believe it would be. The Youth Build Program, yes. I don't know if you can answer this question because I think you were speaking of Hennepin County or...
Noka County.
Noka County, sorry. But would we also have Youth Build up in Bemidji? Do you think that the funding, whatever more or better funding you get in Anoka County, do you think it would be similar in the Bemidji area? Because I'm sure I'll get some questions in the next few days.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would bet you that it's going to be exactly the same as the money that you get. And I believe it's going to be under formula to the workforce centers for the youth. For the youth employment side, there is a youth build in current legislation that's currently in competition out there. We weren't able to compete for that. I know Bemidji was able to compete for that because we didn't have located sites. You needed to have actual specific sites located that you're going to use your youth build on.
Madam Chair, I got a couple follow-ups.
Yes.
It's been my experience that the youth build program has been pretty good. I believe. Chair Clark would probably say the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of money that we might get infused into the state and used in a process like this, are we going to be in a situation where we may get a particular amount of money and maybe not be able to properly spend it in a timely fashion, kind of scratch our heads, and will it look like we're failing? Or would a solution possibly, if that's the scenario, would a solution be to expand slightly the youth build program, maybe Brainerd, Little Falls, St. Cloud, yes. If they don't have that same program?
Madam Chair, Representative, absolutely. I mean, right now the youth has been expanded up to age 24, so 16 to 24, so there is some expansion in the target population. It's for low-income kids. But I think we don't currently run youth build. We're looking at running it. There's plenty of areas throughout the state. I think that could be very valuable to do it. The CAPS have lots of experience in youth build. BICAP is the provider in Bemidji there. And, you know, we do have that statewide network, so we'll be working on it.
And then, Madam Chair, just one final question. I believe you mentioned that you use inmates or jail inmates. When you do this, do the inmates get a stipend, or does the county get a stipend, or wherever they come from, and or who normally would do your weatherization? Are they contractors? Are they licensed contractors? Yeah, are they
Madam Chair, Representative, the prisoner-built program is county inmates. They get a small stipend, but of course they have to pay for their incarceration under the statute. The purpose behind that program is to provide some skill building with some inmates. These are not state correction people. These are county correction people. And we do use a private contractor that supervises the construction side. And then there is a guard that's assigned to the inmates that actually functions as a construction manager on that side, too. So we've been able to build, I don't know, a dozen or so homes throughout the county. The average selling price of those homes are about $170,000 versus the average market is about $300,000. Now, this market is not as good, of course. The house prices are coming down, but that's still a pretty good deal in our county.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Madam Chair, but he opened Pandora's box here for a couple more questions.
Okay, go ahead.
When you say the average price of a house is $170,000, do you get your building permits through specific cities, or do you go through Anoka County? And if so, what would you think of the idea if the legislature told cities and counties that they have to cut their permit fee in half for low-income housing.
Mr. McFarland.
Well, my good friends at the Milk County Board of Commissioners and all my cities, let's see, how do I say that? Madam Chair, Representative, you know, that the permitting fee is a small cost. I mean, there are other fees like the SAC and the WAC charges, park fees and all these other fees that really start adding up, and maybe you may end up with $10,000 of fees in the suburbs by the time you're done.
Mr. Solomon, do you want to translate the SAC and the WAC?
The sewer access charge, water access charge, park access charge, okay. Recreational access charge, and the list goes on and on. We have not taken a position on permit fees. I mean, whatever we can do to make housing more affordable is certainly beneficial. We have added a lot of property tax payers to the tax rolls with these programs, so there's a benefit to the cities, and the cities are willing to work with us, but we have no position on your fee structure. I'll talk to you later if you want.
You will, yeah. Madam Chair.
Final question, Representative Hatch.
Well, Madam Chair, I think it would be a good idea, at least coming from me, which isn't always a good idea, but that this committee maybe put together a bill. If we're really going to do low-income housing, if we want to do it so people can afford the product after we make it, then I think maybe this is a committee where it would originate. We have a bill that says if we're going to have low-income housing, and I don't mean low-income, I mean affordable housing. Maybe that's a better way to say it. We need to figure a better way to build the home for less cost. So if we can force the counties to get rid of the SAC and the WAC on low-cost housing, get rid of the park fees, don't make them put in a 5-foot sidewalk instead of a 4-foot sidewalk, don't make them plant 50 maple trees instead of maybe 10 oaks, those kinds of things, we could lower the price of a house probably $20,000. And I just think that would be a good idea and a good place to start.
Okay, thank you. I think that's a good challenge for this committee. Well, there's a lot of questions tonight. I have some myself, but we're going to go to Representative Hayden next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McFarland, you spoke a little bit about, it just got me to thinking when you talked about the inmate program that you have. That gets me to thinking about just kind of overall the ideal of who is going to be able to participate. We talked about the youth build, and we're talking about inmates, and we're talking about other individuals that may be able to benefit from the money that's going to come from the stimulus package. I think specifically about the inmates, is there a process, and you may or may not know this depending upon your jurisdiction, but it would seem to me that there should be a process that takes those inmates that work on these houses or on these projects and allow them to, once they're released, to be able to be picked up by those same contractors to work directly with your agency so that they can kind of make the reentry, the transition back into society. And I think the first place is to get a job and then typically to get a place to stay, et cetera. So can you talk a little bit about that continuum or what you know about that?
Madam Chair, Representative, I do know that a few of the inmates have been hired by the contractors that we use after they've gotten out. These are not long-term sentence people, mm-hmm. though. These are in county jails,
right?
Or DWIs. So the reentry plan is not as extensive for those folks. I mean, they don't have a whole plan in place. They do have a probation officer. They work with the probation officer, but I think absolutely that we need to do in our society, we need to have an open society. The CAPS, I think, are very good historically at doing placement for disadvantaged populations, whether they be people coming out of the criminal justice system or low-income folks. These are entry-level jobs in various areas, and I think that we have a long-term history of doing that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other question would have to be, you kind of sparked my interest on the entry-level opportunities that may be afforded from the recovery or the stimulus. Do you have a plan in place that that you're able to kind of ramp up those opportunities? For instance, the folks that do the weatherization audits, sounds to me like that is just a small course, a couple of week or a month-long course to be able to identify the labor, the heavy labor deconstruction parts if you're going to do new windows or new furnaces. Can you talk about the CAPS plan to be able to today get that message out and be able to recruit enough folks to get in the process so we have a pool of entry-level folks that will be able to take on these responsibilities?
Madam Chair, Representative, we're fortunate to be co-located and be a partner with the Workforce Center. And the Workforce Center has, you know, literally literally 10, 20, 30 people that work with that population on an ongoing basis. We have the largest workforce center in the state in terms of client volume. We're not funded at the most for Unoka County representatives. I'm going to pay attention to that. But we do have the highest client volume. And I think we've got a good, especially with our public assistance programs, they're also co-located there. So we've got a good one-stop shop, and so we're able to put that all together. Now, saying that, the president just signed this bill yesterday, you know, so we're still kind of working out all the details. It's kind of like George Latimer said. He says, ready, fire, aim. And that's kind of what we're doing now. We're ready, firing, and aiming. And so we don't have all those details, but there's a lot of goals to this program, and we're trying to accomplish a lot of things with it. One of them is to put all of our population to work, including the disadvantaged population.
Just one last question, Madam Chair. Maybe this is for Mr. Anderson. Do you feel, it sounds like Anoka County has a pretty good plan, they're co-located, they're ready to go. Would you feel like all of the CAPs throughout the state, and I know it's very broad, but or at least the major CAP agencies have kind of the same plan and the same readiness as Anoka County has?
Madam Chair and Representative, community action agencies are insinuated into all of their local communities, and we have been preparing for this for a number of months along with our more general activities. As the specifics of the program come down, I'm confident that we will be able to have sufficient labor, have sufficient skills one way or the other, because that's what we do in community action, to deliver a very high-quality program.
Thank you. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for Mr. McFarland, I guess we're really on this topic of the prison labor. I have two questions. I just wondered, you know, have you talked with union contractors? You know, is there any problem with that situation with having, you know, prison labor, which I recognize isn't actually prison labor, it's, you know, county labor,
right,
building houses? And the other one, is this the STS program? I mean, it sounds like STS, yeah. Sentence to Serve?
No, it's not Sentence to Serve. These are actually incarcerated inmates, and they're working out of the Old State Hospital is where they're housed. That's the minimum security facility that Anoka County operates. We have not had any problem with the contractors. We've actually had more problem with the neighbors. You know, when you're building a house and you have a prison crew that comes there, they're worried about, you know, casing the joints and robbing and, you know, pillaging and all that stuff. But we have been able to work with the neighborhood, say, you know, there is a guard, you know, these people are just like your neighbors, except they did something wrong, you know, and that's usually worked out. But we haven't had any negative feedback from any of the contractors.
Okay.
Maybe after this, we will.
Mrs. Fowler, I assume this is women as well as male prisoners.
Yes.
Okay. What percentage would you say?
I don't know that question. Small number.
If you can get me that later, that'd be fine.
The women are also incarcerated up at the state hospital.
I see. They're not just at the county. I wanted to say that to Ms. Sanford, I want to read your document more completely. One of the things that seemed to me a big benefit is that you have these two networks meeting together. There must be quite a exchange of ideas. For example, the question about are all of our CAP agencies on board, I would guess if some of our CAP agencies are more engaged than others, perhaps there's some sharing of ideas that helps stimulate something in another area. Is that happening with with that meeting that happens monthly. I think you said it was both the CAP agencies and the Alliance, which I don't quite know who they are. But
so, Madam Chair, just to clarify, the networks actually operate separate from each other, but within their communities of 28 organizations and 25 organizations, they do an awful lot of this very important peer learning. And so to the question about readiness that was mentioned earlier, I expect that what they will do is they will use their monthly meetings to brief each other. In the same way that Patrick talks about just doing it last night with his board, there will be an awful lot of information sharing as information in this case is coming down from the national government. The Settlement House, the MAC Alliance, is a slightly different example because most of their funding comes from county governments. And so they're actually going to be a very interesting case in the next 6 months. They may be ready and they may have some of the same capacities, but they will not be able to leverage as quickly the federal investments that are coming because of the nature of where their revenue originates from.
So, meetings are just about to begin, it sounds like, rather than they've been ongoing?
They have been ongoing.
They have been ongoing. Mm-hmm. I had just another question for Ms. Miller from Duluth. I love your enthusiasm and the discussion of what's going on. It's very exciting. And I'm hoping it's going on in my own county, in Hennepin County. I don't know if it is to the same extent. I know we have maybe some more dispersal of the sites, perhaps, in Hennepin County. You could maybe comment on that. But I did want to ask you, the one area I didn't hear you talk about is the FAME program, the Family Assets Investment. Are folks encouraged to get involved in that, too? Is that part of...
Yes. We actually, Madam Chair, run the... I believe it's the largest FAME program in the state of Minnesota is run out of Community Action Duluth. And we have a waiting list for the FAME program. It's very popular, and we created a program called Duluth Saves just for people on the waiting list because there were so many. So they are opening bank accounts, taking financial education classes, and meeting with a housing counselor or a credit counselor to start working on their goals. And so they have an unmatched savings account now that they're opening with us. And then we're anticipating 50 new slots in July. And so we are shovel ready because we have this waiting list of people who are ready to go and open their FAME account. So, yes, we do market the FAME program through the tax site.
And I'm not sure all committee members know what that is, but maybe just a very
sure.
brief explanation.
It's the Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota program. We receive state and federal money for the match. People save $40 in a match savings account, and the money is tripled by the program. You have to be under 200% of poverty, and you can use your money for purchasing a home, going to college, or starting or expanding a business. And we have, I believe, about 80 people currently in the FAME program who are saving every month towards their goal.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. I think you're right, Ms. Jennifer. Maybe we do need to have another meeting in the chatterbox. There's just so much that the community action agencies are doing. I really thank you for this presentation this morning. We will have to move on to the next presentation, but thank you very much for coming. And I do want to say that an article has been passed out today from the New York Times about the $75 billion that's going to be available that President Obama announced to fight foreclosures. I'll be interested, and I would invite you actually to visit with me and perhaps with the committee again about how you might work with us on leveraging those dollars, because I think, again, it's getting ready quickly to help claim some of those dollars because of the competitive nature that I believe is there, that we need your help. So I invite you to help us figure that out. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much. I did a little quick research before the hearing today, and I would just like you to know that the Southwest Minnesota Opportunity Council in Worthington has provides energy assistance to 15 families in Kenneth, Minnesota. One employee one citizen is a homemaker who delivers services to vulnerable individuals to keep them in their home. They weatherized one house in Kenneth and 8 on the waiting list. Thank you very much.
For members who don't know, that's where my 92-year-old father lives. I don't know if he has made use of this, but I tell you, that's almost the whole population of Kenneth.
We're very community-based.
Wow. I'm going to be visiting him during this on Thursday night and Friday, and I'll have to ask about this. The coffee shop every morning has a convening of the local citizens. There's about 25 or 30 people that meet in the so-called coffee shop. Kenneth used to be a grocery store, and there's no longer a grocery store there. So the 60-some residents, or 58, depending who's visiting, I'll ask for their input on this. Thank you for that. Heads up. Wow. Okay, our next. Our next presenters are Chip Halbach, who's going to give us an overview of the housing items in the final federal stimulus. Legislation. Remember, it's a constant effort here just to keep up with what's happening with this federal legislation. So I really appreciate Mr. Halbach coming. He's right on top of it and can hopefully help us figure out where we need to go. Welcome to the committee.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Chip Halbach with the Minnesota Housing Partnership. And tried my best to stay on top of these revolving mammoth federal programs, starting with the Housing and Economic Recovery Act in the summer, and the bailout bill, and now the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, which we need to get out of the way before just was mentioned, the new Foreclosure Relief Act to come. But what I will be working off of with this presentation is this grid. Table piece of paper here. What I intend to do is just sort of give you the overview of how this information is structured, and then talk a little bit category by category of what resources we expect in Minnesota as a result of the HR1, or the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, for housing and community development programs. And then finally, I'll leave you with just some thoughts on of what that might mean in terms of the state housing program and how the legislature and this committee might look at the governor's budget in light of these new resources coming in. So first, I've organized the various parts of the Reinvestment Act in different aspects of what it might do for housing in Minnesota. The first one is to address foreclosures and then preserving housing, and at the bottom of this, the front side of the page is fixed public housing. That second column, the legislation, those are the funding amounts or the tax provisions in very brief form that are in the act, which was just signed yesterday by President Obama. Then the third column, which I'll spend my time today, is a best assumption of what, a best calculation of what might be coming to Minnesota as a result of the act. As I believe was mentioned by the community action people, some of the resources are coming to the state by formula. Other resources will come through competitive grant. As the heading of this page shows, I believe that in some total, this state may benefit from over $300 million in housing and community development resources. But as will be shown in a bit, that will very well fund some programs and not cover other specific needs that the state's facing, and there will be some room in the middle where some funds will go for a need, but it won't come close to what that need is. So, first is with the addressing foreclosures, and here is the Neighborhood Stabilization Act, and this follows the funding of that was passed by Congress, which brought $58 million to the state by formula this fall. Here, all of the money that will be made available through the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, which will help take care of foreclosed, vacant, boarded properties in areas of high need, that the based on what we got before, estimated, mind you, $30 million might come for the second round. Now, going for a series of programs related to preserving affordability or rehabbing existing housing. The first on the list there is money that will be made available through a brand new program at HUD for providing energy improvements, greening of federally assisted housing. This would be the Section 8 housing, the 202 senior housing, housing funded over past years by the federal government. I believe that Minnesota's share of that will be almost $4 million, but that is a competitive program. The next is a large amount of money that Congress has made available for funding these project-based Section 8, these where the federal government has made these long-term commitments to fund rent subsidies and specific rental housing development. There, I don't have a dollar amount because basically it's not a new resource. This commitment by Congress only allows Congress and HUD to follow through on their past commitments to make sure that those annual Section 8 contracts do not run out of money. So that's not going to add any new resource to the state or for affordable housing, but it will help owners and tenants avoid some angst that happens a couple of years ago when the federal government actually ran out of money and could not fully fund those contracts. Third is money for addressing lead hazards, and there I'm not certain how much money will come to the state because the priority stated by Congress is to first address those proposals that were made but not funded because of inadequate resources, and maybe someone from Department of Health could help the committee understand if there are any proposals for Minnesota there. The Native American Housing Block Grant Program, it's provided directly by HUD to tribal governments, and this also is part competition, part formula, but the formula is a moving target. And so it's almost like a competition itself. So I, based on past amounts of this type of resource that have been made by the federal government, we expect a little over $2 million would be coming to Minnesota tribes. And I believe, I believe nine tribes receive that resource.
Excuse me, Ms. Halberg, I have to ask you a question. Does this go through the individual tribes? I'm thinking of, the agency has, Urban Indian program as well. So is this going to be limited to the tribal housing?
This is separate from Minnesota housing, Urban Indian or Tribal Indian housing programs. This is money that comes directly to the tribal government from the HUD regional office in Chicago. Then fifth on this list of preserving affordability, rehabbing homes, which very much relates to the prior presentation of resources for weatherization. This is the one program where there was, I think, a significant commitment of funding which will really change the way this work is done in Minnesota. As it nationally, $5 billion was appropriated for weatherization. This goes through the Department of Commerce, and what they've been told by the Department of Energy is about $120 million should come to Minnesota as a result of this. And by contrast, the average annual amount that has come to the state that has been used by these community action agencies through their weatherization programs has been about $10 million per year. So I want to give you some idea of the jump up that we're going to be seeing here. And then finally, there's the extension of the homeowner energy efficient tax credits, and I don't have any information on what that might mean for Minnesota. Moving on to the next category, which is fixing public housing, which is a topic that our agency has spent a lot of time with because the federal government has really lagged in its commitment to maintaining the housing resource that really provides affordable housing for about 20,000 families across the state in over 200 communities. So here, again, this is based on the averages of what Minnesota has received, or Minnesota public housing agencies have received out of these block grants for capital. I believe that the state could receive as much as $56 million, but I should say that nationally, three-quarters of the amount, $3 billion, is being made by granted by formula and $1 billion for competition. So we'll have to find out how Minnesota compares to other public housing agencies across the country. But also, just while that is a significant amount, particularly in contrast to the $2.5 million that was awarded by the legislature about in 2007, which was extremely helpful in helping shore up public housing in the state. But you have to also contrast that with that just the three largest public housing agencies in Minnesota alone, which are Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, have a backlog of needed repairs of over $300 million. So this $56 million, if it comes to the state, is extremely beneficial, but I do not want to leave you with the expectation that our public housing needs will be met. Furthermore, and nationally, the public housing agencies believe that this need for public housing, because it's a wasting resource. Most of these public housing structures were built in the 60s and 1970s, increases by about $2 billion per year, or that equates in Minnesota to about $30 million per year. So this new resource basically takes care of 2 years of the wasting capital asset, which is our state's public housing. Very much needed, but must be seen in that context. Turning the page, what are the resources to produce affordable housing, to expand the state supply? And there, most of the resource being made available by this new legislation really makes up for the loss of value in the federal low-income housing tax credit, which is the major resource that the state of Minnesota uses to build affordable rental housing. About the half of the cost of building affordable rental housing is paid for through these federal low-income housing tax credits. And over the last year, because of there's fewer players in the market, and the market value of tax credits has gone down precipitously, about 20%. So the first item there is through the HOME program, which will run through our state housing agency, there will be about $28 million, and that will be by formula, that will come to help shore up and offset some of that loss in value of the tax credits. Then the second item doesn't provide additional resource, but it allows the state housing agency to take the existing tax credits that developers haven't been able to market and turn those back into the treasury for cash. And so, and I expect from that the state will get an additional $38 million. So that 28 and 38, 50, $66 million will make up for the loss in value of tax credits over 2-3 years. And it will not allow us to do more rental affordable housing, but it will allow the state to take full advantage of those tax credit commitments that have been made 2007, 2008, and 2009. Moving on, community development block grants, $16 million, and that goes to the state plus 17 local governments administer that. The state's portion of the $16 million should be about $5.7 million, and that is distributed by formula, so we should get that. Also then, on a national basis, this bill makes available new resources for the community funds that help spur community development by creating secondary markets. This isn't just housing, it's all of community development, including economic activities. And quite a bit of capacity was increased in these community funds. And again, it's impossible to determine how much benefit will come to Minnesota. All of that will be competitive. Helping people buy homes, the next category here. Well, the big thing, which you've probably heard in the news, is the tax credit for first-time home buyers, which in the earlier bill passed in the summer was $7,500, and it was like a 0% 15-year loan in that you had to pay it back through your taxes at $500 per year. Congress has turned that into an absolute grant credit, so you don't have to pay it back, and increased it to $8,000. And so that should spur a lot of sales of homes for credit-worthy borrowers. Second on there is that there were a number of provisions to increase the marketability of these housing revenue bonds. And I don't know how much the committee has been apprised of this, but because of what's gone on into the national financial market, the state and local government's ability to sell bonds, to raise money, to purchase mortgages of first-time home buyers has been nearly shut down. And so Congress here is trying to provide some removal of the alternative minimum tax to increase the marketability of the bonds. Our officials from our housing finance agency believe that these are good things, but in the current market still will not help them sell those bonds so that they can help make the first-time homebuyer loans. So that's a very important housing issue still facing the state. And then also for rural housing, there is significant new resources for the 502 rural housing loans, both the direct loans and the insured loans. Finally, meeting basic need for housing. There, the emergency shelter grant program is receiving significant new resources. And Minnesota's share of that, which will come by formula, should be almost $24 million, and that goes out to a number of local governments, plus the state agency, Department of Human Services, and the portion of this coming to Department of Human Services, $11-some million. I should say also, while that amount will nowhere near address the rapid increase in homelessness that we're seeing across the state, it's a multiple 7-8 to 10 times what we've been receiving in Minnesota on an annual basis from that program. And finally, here is the FEMA Emergency Food and Shelter Program. I'm less aware of that, but just proportionately, and not aware of how that will be distributed, but that could bring another $1 million plus to Minnesota. Summing all of this up, we have, as it was, I started out, over $300 million. But just to be clear, about $165 million of that will come to state government through these four state agencies, Commerce, MHFA, BEAD, and DHS, $165 million. Most of that, but well over half of that, is coming to the Department of Commerce for the weatherization program, in lesser amounts to the other three agencies. Local government will receive, by formula, a total of $63 million, and most of that is for to the public housing agencies. There's 124 public housing agencies across the state, so that money gets really spread out. And then for community development block grants, there's 17 governments that will receive that $10 million there, and then five communities, in addition to the state, receive the emergency shelter grants. So of the dollar amounts that I have in this table, there's about $54 million, I believe, can come to Minnesota, but Minnesota agencies will have to compete for it. And to push us over to the $300 million, you have to include that $38 million that the Housing Finance Agency can take advantage of by swapping existing low-income housing tax credits for cash with Treasury. What does that mean in terms of our state housing budget, and what questions should it raise? So just briefly, my interpretation on that is, as I look across the programs that the state has funded and the governor's proposing budget amounts, I'll first say that the Challenge Fund, which we'll speak of later in terms of its job benefit to the state, the Challenge Fund is the state's most flexible program for developing affordable housing, rehabbing existing housing, and that. And I believe that, if anything, these resources coming from the federal government should support increasing the level of challenge resources, because the NFP dollars, for instance, now that we know how much that is and it's all competitive, the competition itself, one of the factors they will take into account is local state dollars allocated for that purpose. And the resource that would be coming to the state will only, as I said earlier, address about 5% of the foreclosed vacant homes. So the Challenge Fund does enable, through its flexibility, the state housing agency to put money to address that need. Also, as I was saying, we have a desperate need for affordable rental housing for extremely low-income families, households, seniors. And the federal government does not expand the amount of resources available for that purpose. It does allow some fixing up of existing rental housing, but the Challenge Fund can both help match the federal dollars that are available through the tax credits, so we fully take advantage of those tax credits and federal resources, plus be used to create additional affordable rental housing. And then also, as I believe been mentioned earlier, is the Challenge Fund also provides that great flexibility that allows the state to get out ahead of what's happening and take advantage of the collapse of land values and prices through various agencies, local governments, nonprofits, be able to do some land banking to reduce our long-term cost in affordable housing. Now, I should also say that because of what's happening with the federal government, I would, and the resources coming to the state, I think the TCAT program, which is the Housing Counseling Program, and the capacity building program, which helps nonprofits do counseling work on one and put more and just shore up their infrastructure to help them take advantage of these resources coming in, would be a good place for a state investment. Now, we will have to see with this new foreclosure legislation if it also provides counseling dollars, if so that might take some of the burden off counseling dollars. But if not, we want to make sure that we have these, we complement what's going on with the federal government, so we have in place a strong network of counselors. Pat McFarland talked about the five in Anoka County, to make sure that we keep that counseling infrastructure in place to take advantage of these other federal resources coming down. And I also would say that with the Housing Finance Agency nonprofit capacity building program, it's the same thing in terms of helping take advantage of federal resources. Where I think the state should reexamine its current budget is with the HAF program, the Housing Affordability Fund, that helps first-time home buyers connected with MHFA mortgages, Minnesota Housing Mortgages, and both in terms of what's happening with the bond market and also that other resource with the $8,000 credit coming from the federal government. I believe it would be good for that program to be rethought. Either less funds would be needed or that it needs to be repositioned to take advantage of and respond to this changing reality. The same with the homeownership rehab program or the rental rehab program. It's to, with all of the weatherization resources coming in, how does that program need less funding, or how can it be repositioned so that state resources work around, maximize the benefit to the with the federal resources coming in? And finally, just on the Housing Trust Fund, the governor is proposing to take resources out of the Challenge Fund and put into the Housing Trust Fund as part of the planned and long-term homelessness. Now, the issue there that Dan Bartholomew, the state commissioner, said they're working on is that for that plan to move forward, you need three components. You need money to construct the housing, which in part is done through the Challenge Fund and these tax credits. You need money to operate the housing, which is done through the Housing Trust Fund, but you also need services. And the services dollars aren't there. Now, the state is trying to work with this new federal resource to free up money that can go into services. So if that happens, then that transfer of money for the long-term homeless makes a lot of sense. If that doesn't happen, then I think that money still is needed in the Housing Trust Fund, but maybe more flexibly to help families with rent subsidies that might not be in supportive housing. So I just will leave you with those thoughts in terms of the budget and how at least I am thinking as an advocate for affordable housing in the state. I'm thinking about this new set of programs and resources coming to the state and how we can take best advantage of those federal resources with increasingly scarce state resources and do what we can to address the need for foreclosures, for people who need rental housing, to address homelessness.
Wow, that's a lot of information. I want to thank you for bringing that to us in a really organized fashion. I have one request myself, which is I would also like a visual graphic that shows those places where we can, where we need to compete for the federal dollars by having a state match or somehow leveraging it. And I was trying to keep track as you went along, but I know that I didn't get it all. And so I'm just wondering, and you've got it in the chart here, and that's good. I'm just wondering if you could create an additional target for this committee, because I think we do, as a committee, we really have a challenge. I mean, we have an opportunity to use these federal dollars. We have to figure out how to match them and leverage them. And in those cases where we don't need to do that, it would be helpful to be clear about that. And I don't know if anybody else has questions. I think Representative Stevenson, you had a question, but if anybody else wants to help figure this out as we go forward, I really invite you. The committee is probably going to go forward with our committee bill that will try to make sense of all this, because we have a fabulous opportunity out of a terrible crisis, in my opinion. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted, on some of the issues, Mr. Hallback, that you were speaking to, you said that on the affordable, or on the housing, well, it's the public housing stock that we have in the state, that's about $300 million in arrears in terms of upkeep, and those are the dollars that are... Can you tell me how many people we have on public housing?
Madam Chair, Representative. There's 20,000 households, and I believe it's about 38,000 people live in public housing in Minnesota. Most of whom are elderly or disabled. So it's a major housing resource for that very vulnerable population, but there are over 10,000 children too.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of follow-ups here. You also mentioned some of the dollars in terms of land and banking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and buying some of the property when they're low. When we do as a state do that, and we buy property and then we put it into public housing, do we take that off the tax rolls?
Madam Chair, Representative, typically not. And I'm trying to think of examples. That's an existing use of challenge fund dollars. And the one example that comes to mind is where Habitat for Humanity in the Twin Cities was able to buy it in Chaska, I believe, but some land at a very low price to allow them to plan several years out in their build out. I believe that would be a more typical use of this new thinking that's been going on at the state agency and some of the nonprofit funders about it's been, you know, land has been hundreds of thousands of dollars an acre in some of these hard to create housing in suburban communities, and prices have fallen measurably, and not to do a huge investment, but it's strategically, such as near transit stops and other schools, etc., places where it might make sense to put affordable housing in the future.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. And I guess to that point, I'm not sure I got an answer out of that issue, but if we purchase the land and we put it into, say, Habitat for Humanity, which I think typically they build houses, and they try and build affordable houses that are in turn turned over to private families,
yeah,
who are able to buy them at a lower rate, who in turn pay property taxes. So when you're talking about increasing the public housing inventory through purchasing land that we have access lower now, any month that we have those on the Minnesota housing inventory for public housing is a month that they don't pay increased taxes, which in my estimation would say that then that property tax is shifted onto the remaining taxpayers within the district. So I understand what you're talking about, trying to capitalize on a downturn in the economy. However, we do have tax obligations that we are trying to minimize the impact so we can keep the revenues coming in. And I guess my concerns would be that we don't get myopic on this whole affordable housing issue and say, hey, this is a great time to capitalize and increase the inventory, because quite honestly, there are serious questions as to how much inventory we can afford. And I appreciate you coming before the committee. I'm just curious, Madam Chair, is Minnesota Housing Finance Agency going to come before the committee with their take on the stimulus package?
Absolutely. We have them scheduled on Tuesday.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Could I just respond briefly?
Of course, and I think... Go ahead. You go first.
Yeah, I just want to make clear, since there are many programs here and it's easy to confuse or tie them together, public housing is not expanding. When I mentioned the Challenge Fund and its use in through the state agency, which provides grants, I don't know if it's 90% or it's at least 90%. It may be 100%. It goes to private entities. They may be nonprofit or for-profit to buy land for development, and that land and those developments do pay property taxes, albeit at a lower rate than other rental property tax rates if it's rental housing, but it does pay property tax.
Well, Mr. Halbach, isn't it also correct? What we're talking about here is fixing public housing, not expanding it. Mm-hmm. We have so much deterioration in our public housing right now that the need is just huge. I think that's what these federal dollars and what we actually could do with some state dollars. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Halbach.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Huntley, you were right up there. Do you mind, Representative Hayden? I didn't mean to skip over you.
Well, Madam Chair, I just have a comment or a suggestion for something that you might look at, and it's the weatherization going from $10 million to $120 million. A lot of people are going to be put to work in this, and since we're in the WPA room, in the early 80s, Duluth had 18% unemployment, and we set up a program to, in the case of Duluth, to hire a bunch of young people in the summer to clean up the parks and work on the parks. This is such a, it's just a huge amount of money. And maybe we ought to think about setting up a WPA kind of project to put kids to work and maybe let them move into the construction trade. I've talked to some labor people, and they're interested in participating with training kids through this, so that they would go on and get into the construction trades later. But I'm sure there's other committees that have similar amounts of money that are coming into them. And if the environmental committees are getting money to fix up parks, they could do the same thing. And perhaps we ought to talk to some of the other committees and look at what can be done to hire young people during this. They're not going to be able to get jobs. We're going to have all the adults looking for jobs. Kids just aren't going to get the kind of jobs that they've had. And this is a program that might be able to focus on those kids and get them to work and get the work done, too.
Mr. Halbach, did you care to comment on this?
Well, thank you, and Chair Representative Huntley. That very much dovetails with the presentation from the community action programs, because they're very good at organizing communities, and including young people in communities, to do that. I do know that state leaders in housing finance and Department of Commerce are thinking of a variety of strategies to employ this very important new resource to the state, and to do things like you're thinking about in terms of going out in the homes and weatherizing them and using young people to do that, but also in terms of using this as one layer of a resource, set of resources that are needed for the foreclosed homes that are vacant, boarded homes that for which there's, as I mentioned earlier, we have 5% of the resources to treat 5% of the homes. So you need to be able to tie, as painful as that is, to tie together all of these resources, and part of the weatherization money, I believe, will be employed that way.
I might point out that Representative Kalen's bill that went through here last week, this was really addressed the weatherization issues, and I know that they're looking specifically at this as part of the Green Jobs Task Force. And that bill, I believe, had a hearing today, maybe at the same time in another committee, and it's going through four or five different committees. And I think the one thing that's a little bit new about what I heard you say that I think is really important, and if it was what Representative Hall was talking about earlier, which is making sure that some of the youth have a chance to participate in that. And the pre-apprenticeship program that Youth Build is involved in might be one of the ways to bring that forward. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Well, I was, Madam Chair, I used to sit next to a very conservative Democrat when I was on the city council, and when that program started, he said, I said, why did you support that? And he said, Tom, this is so that these kids can put on their resume that they could show up for work every morning and work 40 hours a week. So there's some real potential in this to not only do the weatherization, but to help kids.
Right. President Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Harbach, I just wanted to get your comments. I haven't followed it closely, but as part of the housing bill today, the federal housing relief, the provision around homeowners that are upside down in their mortgage, can you talk just in that there might be some opportunity that if they can't renegotiate with their lender that they might be able to get a new loan through Freddie, through the Fannie and Freddie organizations? Could you talk about that a little bit? How do you know?
Very little, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hayden. I know that there's a plan in the works that isn't detailed, but the plan would provide partial federal subsidies to help reduce the interest costs of people who are facing foreclosure, to help renegotiate and the lender would receive some federal insurance so that it would be a solid loan that would go forward and it would be affordable to that homeowner. And beyond that, I really can't speak. I want to look at the details as they're released with this program because I do think it will be a very important resource for the state. And just like with this bill act we've been discussing, we need to figure out how we in Minnesota can and take best advantage of the tools the federal government will be offering us.
Thank you. Ms. Harbach, we've run out of time, and I know we still have yet to hear from you about the report on the economic stimulus, but I think it was a good use of our time today, so I'd like to invite you to come back for that part. And I think by then, too, we will know more about the announcement that happened today in terms of the $75 billion. It's $25 more than I heard about earlier this morning. So
might be $100 by tonight.
$2 billion here and there. and I really appreciate that. So if you wouldn't mind coming back, we'll have you come back again along with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. So we have before us, members, the minutes of February 17th, and I'm thinking Representative Hayden might have had a chance to look at them. And
February the 17th.
Representative Hayden moves the approval of the minutes of February 17th. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the motion are adopted. The committee is adjourned until next Tuesday. Thank you, committee members.